Wait, what's a niece? A niece is your... Is
what? It's a girl.
Wait, what?
I told you guys, I was up all night. A niece is your...
Like your
a,
sibling's like daughter.
Sibling's daughter. Right?
Whoa.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and today we're going to take an in-depth look at Senator Elizabeth Warren's bid for the Democratic nomination. So Warren has been in second place in the Real Clear Politics average of national primary polls for a little over a week now, and it's the first time that she's claimed that spot apart from a one-day blip back in July, and she overtook Senator Bernie Sanders to get there. Warren is now polling around 17% to Biden's 30% and Sanders' 16% in those national averages. And as some measure of the conventional wisdom, a week ago, Warren overtook Biden as the likeliest to win the nomination, according to betting markets on Predictit. It was just a handful of months ago that Warren was polling fifth or sixth nationally with numbers in the mid-single digits. And following the backlash to the release of her DNA test, she seemed like a long shot. So here with me to talk about how Warren made her comeback and what her staying power looks like are senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Also with us is managing editor Micah Cohen.
Hello.
And joining us from Louisville, Kentucky is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to see you guys.
Likewise. And Nate is out today. But also later in the show, we are going to take stock of how the conversations about mass shootings and white nationalist terrorism have developed in the 2 weeks since the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. But let's begin with Warren. And perhaps we can think of this as an updated theory of the case like we did when candidates originally got in the race. So, Claire, for starters, how do you think about how Warren made her comeback from fifth or sixth in the polls nationally?
So I'll kind of crib from a very good piece by Walter Shapiro in The New Republic. He did a profile of Warren, and he basically is talking about this whole narrative of her sort of gradually ticking up in the polls. And he's saying, you know, what changed, you know, in the movie version of this, how would it play out? And his answer is nothing really changed. She's sort of been doing the same exact thing the entire time. And it seems like the slow and steady wins the race kind of thing. Not literally, but slow and steady ticks up in the polls and overtakes the second on the leaderboard for polling average, I guess, in the 538 parlance. But I think to answer it more fulsomely, she has, over a period of several months, basically since she launched, built an identity that is surrounded by policy plans. Now, there's like this whole meme, this whole thing that her campaign is sort of trying to use of the, I have a plan for that. She has t-shirts, all this stuff. Now, if you read, some of the plans are more detailed than others, but they are all out there in, you know, 2,000 to 2,500 words on Medium. And so you can read them. And so the idea is she's sort of presenting herself as eminently prepared to govern. I have a vision of this, all this stuff. And she is caught on among essentially Hillary Clinton voters, I would say, of the Democratic primary electorate, like a surprising number of professional urbanites or like college educated white people, which tend to be like the readership of the New York Times and the columnists of the New York Times. So there's a certain, I would call it word of mouth energy that's a little bit of a trickle down from the top. Is that a good kickoff?
Yeah, it is a good kickoff, and I agree with all of it, except I do think there is a distinction between Warren's voters and Clinton's voters. I mean, there's overlap there. But as you would expect with Clinton, you know, she was polling at 60% in the polls and Warren has, you know, 15 to 20%. Warren's support is much more limited to very liberal, white, educated, urban, religiously unaffiliated than Clinton's support was. Clinton's support was a little more diverse.
Sure. I guess yes. I mean, a two-person primary field versus
of course, yeah.
However many person primary field. And I guess I say Clinton voters to Warren voters because Warren is so has so much in common policy-wise with Sanders. I think it's just notable to say that she is, as much as she is the economic candidate, she is an identity candidate for a certain kind of Democrat that wants that woke white person vision of America. Like Elizabeth Warren is to them sort of safe because they ran a middle-aged white lady before, and you could either go with the thing of, well, she won the primary and she won the popular vote, but you can also say, well, she lost the Electoral College. But Warren kind of combines that, like, oh, the populism of Bernie. I don't know. There's a certain like safeness, I think, that a lot of Democrats seem to be starting to feel with Warren, that to me feels a little bit like, oh, these are the kind of people who shunned Bernie Sanders, but now a person who holds a lot of his politics is being embraced by them. That's kind of what I'm trying to get
at. No, and I agree with that. And actually, it's notable. We ran a piece last week that showed that Warren is actually, from if you look at who people voted for in 2016, Warren is actually drawing her support equally from Bernie voters in 2016 and Clinton voters in 2016, which I think is notable, as you say, because she has so much policy similarity with Bernie. It suggests this other thing going on with her drawing from Clinton voters.
I think it's interesting that you describe her as feeling safe to some people. And we can get more into what doubts people may have or whether they really do think she is safe in either the primary or the general. But before we get to that, Perry, can you weigh in here on how Elizabeth Warren has risen steadily from fifth or sixth nationally now to second?
So I think she actually had a really good campaign strategy to line up with her. So you have to campaign for, you know, more than a year. So her thing is, I'm the wonkiest of the wonkiest of the wonky. And each week I'm going to roll out, or each 2 weeks I'm going to roll out a plan. Something in America happens. And though she has a plan, so it fits really well into a campaign. Like, if you compare her to Joe Biden's campaign, is basically, I'm electable. You can only say that one, you can say that every day, but it's not a particularly interesting way to campaign. Kamala Harris's campaign is like, I'm left, but not that left. And that's sort of like, is about other people, not you. Pete's is about, I'm young, and he says I'm young in a variety of ways, but it's still the same message. I think Warren has a great way to sustain a year-long campaign, and you can tell people, like, every issue she has a response to, she is in the news cycle. People are talking about her. Other candidates are reacting to her. I just think it's a really well-organized and thought-out campaign.
Do you think that this is somewhat of a reversion to the mean, in the sense that this is where we would have expected her to be all along without the negative coverage and backlash surrounding the DNA test? Or is this something totally different? Like, this is a strong campaign working its way up through the polls. And when she was fifth or sixth, it wasn't just about the DNA thing. That's really where she was naturally, and she's progressed since.
Both?
I don't know. I mean, I thought an interesting thing that Walter's piece pointed out was that, and I'd kind of forgotten this, I think we talked a lot about how she made this announcement about, listen, we're not going to take big fundraising, big donors, dollars, and her head of finance quit. And she really spent a lot in the first couple of months in early states, kind of building up like an organization. And his line in that piece is like, you can build up an organization and do the media after, but you can't have a months-long organization whenever, right? There's some things that need to come into place first. So maybe it's a sense of like, oh yeah, they've kind of been plugging and chugging the whole time and had a vision of what this is going to be. I do think, though, their initial stumbles with the Native American DNA test did belie a certain blind spot of the candidate and probably her inner circle, which is not as diverse and not as like with it necessarily, but they seem to course correct pretty quickly on that, all things speaking, for this campaign.
I think a lot of it is just kind of reversion to the mean. I mean, if you remember when she was languishing in the low single digits in the polls, we were all sitting here being like, well, yeah, why isn't she doing better, even weeks after the DNA test controversy? The other part I do think is what Perry said, which is she's, and what Claire just mentioned, which is she's run a really good campaign. It's been substantive. I think she's been smart about organizing in the early states, having that infrastructure. The other thing, though, is she's caught some breaks in terms of who else has struggled. So one, Bernie, I think, has, well, I think it's safe to say the campaign for Bernie hasn't gone as well as they probably hoped, just in terms of he starts off really high name recognition, pretty meaningful support in the polls. That support dips a little bit. He's kind of feels a little bit, I think, like a rerun of 2016, not a lot of new notes. Warren capitalizes on that. Beto O'Rourke's struggles, I also think, have been kind of inherently good for Warren.
In the sense that he's the white college-educated liberal.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're trying to target, at least as a first step, the kind of super educated, super liberal white segment of the Democratic Party, the other candidates going for that doing poorly helps you, right? Even Buttigieg, the fact that the Buttigieg surge kind of has tapered off a bit, I think that's helped her too.
So Micah's saying the other candidates have underperformed. I do think Biden had a very logical theory of the case. Warren kind of bumbled into, she couldn't run on electability because no one thinks she's electable. So she sort of bumbled into a good strategy of running as an issues person. I feel like Beto, Booker, Pete, and Harris are all trying to run the Obama campaign of 2008. I'm not left. I'm not center. I'm charismatic. Look how charming and exciting I am. And I do think that that strategy may have not worked. And so Warren had an opening to run sort of a policy-based campaign because she was running against four people who were kind of really not saying anything. And then Biden, who was to the right of her.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense because there is that sort of inchoate, I'm going to make a soaring speech edge of things. And then there's Biden, who does just say, like, I'm good friends with Barack, and also you know me. I will say, like, she has, to Warren's credit, got into electoral politics very recently, but her brand was always incredibly specific. I mean, think about her first kind of national viral moment. I think it was this video of her doing that very small in someone's house speech about, if you're wealthy in America, you used our roads, you right. did all these things, you like didn't you that. Didn't get rich by yourself. And I do think she has a little bit of that, God forbid I use this to describe a politician, but folksiness, right? Like there is a, and by the way, she plays it up to the nth degree on the trail. Her her stump speech is
a, folksy.
Yes. Perhaps she, anyway, it's very folksy, but I think that that's kind of authentic to who she is. I mean, I've talked about this with friends before about the way she presents herself is actually quite different from a lot of female politicians. Let's just look at like Harris, Gillibrand, and Klobuchar all dress in the confining tailoring of the of a professional woman, right? For lack of a better word. Sheath dresses, sharp suits, pearls. In fact, Harris, sidebar, there's a sort of like interesting little thing she has with like, she always wears pearls because someone, a relative brought her pearls back. But like, really, she just wears pearls because pearls are what you wear when you're in public life and you want to look pretty, but you don't want to be distracting. Anyway, Elizabeth Warren wears loose sweaters. And when she goes on the debate stage, she kind of wears her own version of like a suit jacket, but it's not quite the suit jacket that other women wear. She kind of looks like your mom's friend who wears either Eileen Fisher or something more down market.
And like athleisure almost sometimes.
Yeah. And it's kind of this, that's probably how your grandma or your mom dresses. And I think that's sort of to her strength.
And I should also note that after we recorded our podcast last week, a video of Warren went viral of her running up on stage in New Hampshire. I saw several people comment on Twitter like, oh, Claire pointed that out last week, that the older candidates are always trying to show themselves running and being active in order to, you know, make the case that they're not too old to be president.
It says, yes, she is projecting like, I'm your spry grandma.
So we've described where Elizabeth Warren is right now, but of course she's still in second place and barely in second place, kind of just got there. Biden is still more than 10 points ahead of her in the national polling averages. And when you look at Warren's support, as we've already described, it's very white, it's very college educated, it's very liberal, it's very one part of the Democratic Party. So how does she get from here to there? And that's kind of the question that we asked when a lot of these candidates got in the race, which was, what's their theory for the case? How do they win the nomination? So Perry, what do you see? What would have to happen from here for Warren to become the Democratic nominee?
So I tend to see it in terms of states, and I can see it very clearly that she could win Iowa because there is that white liberal base in Iowa that exists for her. She could win New Hampshire because another white state, very educated, near where she lives. And then from there, if she could win those first two primaries, not easy at all, but totally a real possibility, then I think it becomes a question of like, I think she's going to struggle in the South with a lot of sort of more conservative white voters and African Americans who are, I think, going to be more closely to Biden or Harris, somebody else like that. But I think if you win those first two primaries, that gives you the momentum and helps her sort of grow her base. Maybe she gets some endorsements after that. Yeah, I think the question is, how does she grow her base outside of what you described? And I think the answer is some early wins probably help with that.
Yeah. Like, I could potentially see Warren doing kind of well in Nevada. Like getting maybe a big union endorsement because she speaks the language of unions, her having an organized team on the ground, turning people out to those caucuses, that could be good. And then you could get momentum. I agree with Perry. Like, there's a lot of votes in the South, and she probably isn't going to get those, but she could win a few one of the two Super Tuesdays. You know, she could get some of those Midwestern states. I could see her winning Michigan. I mean, Sanders won Michigan in 2016. Who's not to say that she couldn't win a thing like that? So you could see her making her way through Oklahoma, let's say. I mean, you know, just states where we don't think about, but there are votes hiding. And I actually think, to her credit, actually to a lot of the candidates' credits, you are seeing them say, I'm campaigning here in Mississippi or Alabama, and I'm going to come back, right? Like, the idea that they are Warren as a white candidate and the current candidate of, like, white college-educated people is cognizant of the fact that it would be embarrassing if she had no black support or outreach. Like, that is an important part of the Democratic coalition.
Well, and not just embarrassing, but also perhaps not viable, her candidacy to win the nomination. So we've talked about maybe a strategy in terms of just the sequence of primaries, but where does she actually have upside in terms of voters? Like, which other candidates could she gain support from if they faltered? You know, because even where she is now, she still wouldn't win
candidate
the
poker.
Iowa caucus.
Whose cards does she get when they fold?
Okay, so one, there's a share of Biden supporters who are mostly with Biden now, just because they think he's the most electable. So if Warren wins Iowa and New Hampshire, you would imagine all of a sudden she seems a lot more electable because she's winning elections. You know, she picks up, let's say, a handful of percentage points from Biden. Sanders has been sort of like hovering at around, I don't know, what's he been at, like 13, 14, 15% in national polls. You know, if he is stuck there all the way up until Iowa, what does he do? I think that's a really interesting question.
He's not going to drop out.
I mean, do you think there's any circumstance in which Elizabeth Warren could make the argument to Sanders, if you don't drop out, Biden will win, so if you believe in your cause, back
sure.
me?
Yeah.
And would that be convincing to Bernie Sanders?
You'd have to ask Bernie.
I think it's totally possible Bernie Sanders would endorse Warren if she... He definitely is not going to endorse Biden. So I think there's
until the spring. Yeah, there's a possibility, but I don't think it happens until like after March. And that's more reading into like the psychology of Bernie Sanders as a true believer in his singular cause.
In Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. And this is not to like slag Bernie extra.
No,
they're all true believers in themselves. But they're all crazy. But like, we also have the template of 2016 as some sort of indication of how Bernie might make a decision, which is to say, like, he was a little like play to the whistle kind of guy. So I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do this time around. But.
So here's another way to think about it is, what demographic characteristics does Warren kind of over-index with right now, and could she improve her support among the opposite of that? In other words, right now, Warren does disproportionately well with very liberal voters. And when you go to somewhat liberal, she does worse. And when you go to moderate conservative, she does way worse. Could you see her doing a little bit better with somewhat liberal voters? Maybe, but she's really liberal, you know, so I think that'll be tough. Look at race, right? She does really well. She does disproportionately well with white voters, worse with black voters, worse with Hispanic voters. How could she reverse that? That's a little hard to see, too, honestly. It's the same problem Bernie had. The one area where I can imagine it happening more, and remember, though, these demographic groups all overlap, right? So this actually isn't a perfect way to think about it, but she over-indexes right now with very well-educated voters. But you could imagine, if she does it right, her kind of populist structural change message resonating with voters without a college education, voters who just have a high school degree, in the same way Trump's populist message did. Still, though, it is a little bit of the of the Bernie problem. The only other thing I'd say is, if you look at like how it this is all from a really interesting Pew report that came out. But right now, the support by candidate isn't super differentiated by gender. There's not a candidate that's doing really well among women or men relative to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to see if that stays the same or changes depending on how the field winnows.
I think the point about Warren, I don't frankly ever see her excelling or competing with Biden or Harris, like Perry sort of predicted, with black voters in the South. But I do think she has an opportunity to win over moderate white voters and to make an argument that in the general election, she could do something to appeal to more moderate people. And what I think is interesting that her campaign hasn't done more of is play up the fact that she used to be a Republican, play up the fact that she took a little bit of a winding road to get to her liberal positions. She, in fact, almost like a full lifetime to get to those positions. And I think that that's actually, it's less of a neat narrative than single working mother, which is currently sort of the thread of her stump speech, grew up in a, you know, household teetering on the edge of the middle class and poverty. But I think that idea that she was a Republican for much of her adult life is very compelling if you want to win over those more moderate voters. And I think this is where some of the weird how women and men are perceived when they try to do populism is really interesting, because while Warren grew up super middle class and spent most of her life as a Republican, she sort of reads as woman Harvard professor, whereas Joe Biden, who has been a senator since he was 30, you know, has been in the national spotlight for a long time, is still Scranton Joe in a lot of people's eyes, middle class Joe. And so it's just a little bit of a different valence on those two things.
All right, let's continue this conversation in just a minute. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. It's the middle of the night. You're tossing and turning, not sleeping, drenched, covered in sweat. Sure, running the AC or fan all night can help a bit, but to sleep really cool and comfortable, get rid of your heat-trapping mattress and get a Casper. The Casper combines four layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool all night, all summer long. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. Casper also has free shipping and returns, so you'll be able to try your Casper mattress for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. Sleep cool and comfortable every night. Get a Casper. Try yours for 100 nights with free shipping and returns. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code politics, and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. All right, we're back, and we were just talking about perhaps some of the ways in which Elizabeth Warren could pick up ground with other parts of the electorate and maybe in a sequential fashion win the nomination by convincing people that she is, in fact, electable. I want to read a quote, actually, from columnist Henry Olson in The Washington Post and see what you got, if you think this is right, and we'll go to you, Perry. He wrote, "Warren's tactics so far have more in common with those of evangelical religious right Republican candidates than with eventual nominees. Those men, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, and Ted Cruz, used strong support from a large party faction to win early knockouts of other candidates with broader base support, but they each lost when the race winnowed down to the final stage because the factors that earned them support from the religious right alienated them from the party's silent majority." Perry, to you, does that sound like Warren and perhaps an argument for why she wouldn't go on to win the nomination?
Not quite. The idea, I guess, here is that college-educated voters in the Democratic Party are like evangelicals in the Republican Party. I don't totally see it that way. But I guess what I would say is, kind of being the candidate of white people with college degrees is limiting. That's about a third of the Democratic voters voted for Hillary. I do think one natural place for Warren to go is to go to, there are college-educated people who are not white. So that's a part of the Democratic Party that we don't talk about a lot, but that's one place where it would be logical. Like, you can imagine sort of a Stacey Abrams-style person that came down to Biden versus Warren would want to, I think, would endorse Warren over Biden. And I wonder if you get some more black elected officials, Hispanic elected officials, people who are prominent to endorse Warren down the line, that she won't necessarily win the black vote, but she'll, like, narrow the... Because the key thing is she can't have a gap that the Sanders-Clinton gap was so big you can't make up for that. If Warren can sort of have a more narrow gap, that's the key. It's not – she can't be so – I think Henry's right that she can't be so factional that she can't win.
I think the other – I mean, talking about getting like prominent – politicians and surrogates of color in certain states would be powerful for her. People have made a lot of sort of like in the inside baseball stuff about, oh, would she choose Castro as a running mate? They seem kind of chummy. They seem kind of like they've complimented each other publicly. So the idea that someone like that dropping out and endorsing her, you know, like that, if you're playing that kind of game or getting certain prominent mayors, like Andrew Gillum, that endorsement will matter, I think, when it happens. Like, there are people like that around the country who could basically like lend her credibility, sort of like, to be a little bit frank about it, kind of do what Obama does for Biden, which is sort of lend Elizabeth Warren like more reach in minority communities and more credibility.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I should also say, and this to slightly correct what I said earlier, in that Pew poll, and I think this goes to the Castro point, Warren did best among white voters. Like I said, she got 20% of first choice support, but she actually didn't do that much worse among Hispanic voters. She got 14% of their first choice support. She got 4% among black voters. So maybe that suggests that Hispanic voters are a logical sort of like next step for her, which overlapped with what Perry said about college-educated non-white voters. The other thing, though, and I think this gets at Claire's point, and it's a key advantage Warren has over Bernie, even though we're talking about how, like, in some ways they have the same problem in terms of how they build out their coalition. I do think it's more likely, as Claire said, that Warren can get elite endorsements than Sanders has been able to or will be able to. For whatever reason, she's just, I mean, there are a lot of reasons, but she's just more a part of the establishment. And then the last thing I'll say to that point about is the kind of very liberal college educated white section of the Democratic Party akin to the evangelical section of the Republican Party, and therefore is Warren a factional candidate in the way that Santorum was? I think this gets at the conversation we were having on the podcast last week about Iowa, right? Iowa in both parties is defined by those factions, right? For Republicans, evangelicals, for Democrats, very liberal white voters. And yet, Iowa's been predictive in the Democratic Party, but not predictive in the Republican Party. And I think that's why is a complicated question. But for whatever the reason, it does suggest that the relationship between those factions and the larger party is different between the two parties.
Perry, as Elizabeth Warren has gained steadily in the polls, does it seem like concerns about her quote-unquote electability have subsided at all?
I mean, I read these polls to say more people think she's electable than they did 6 months ago. I read them, but I don't. I'm sort of dubious about them.
Wait, why?
I know we're a data focused website, but if you ask regular people, you just go to South Carolina tomorrow and ask people can Warren or Harris win? They'll say, Are you insane? We just watched Hillary lose. You know, I mean, I think the women can't win is a really deep feeling among Democrats, and I think that's her biggest barrier.
Is it more about her ideology or her gender at this point, does it seem, those questions?
I think it's people say it's about her ideology because that's safe to say in columns and on TV. But if you actual voters talk about gender a lot because they don't know much about ideology.
I think we underestimate the truly pessimistic streak running through the Democratic primary electorate in general. Just the idea of people not voting necessarily for what they want in their heart of hearts, but what their brain tells them they should do because they're sort of trying to seek out what other people want. And yes, I mean, I think there's just a lot of pessimism about who can win and where America is right now after Hillary Clinton and after Obama's presidency.
I was interviewed by a Vogue reporter, and to Claire's point, the
so chic, Micah.
Well, I was telling Claire last week that I appeared in Vogue with Taylor Swift. Was it?
Yeah, Micah and Taylor Swift
hit
Vogue the same day.
I don't know if my quote is
one of them was a cover story.
Yeah, one of us made the cover.
One of them, I like that.
But the the conceit of the article was about Democrats who are resigned to Trump winning re-election, which I think there is this streak in the Democratic Party of deep pessimism about what voters are ready for. And
but that, I actually thought the premise of that article was interesting, because I mean, it's not a crazy bias to have that Trump might well win the election. I mean, he is the sitting president.
He has a very good shot of winning. That's not crazy to think. It's like preordained is not supported.
What at this point can we, what do the numbers tell us about how people view Warren's electability?
They view her as not as electable as people like Biden or even like Bernie. I think Bernie's viewed as more electable than Warren is.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, we actually haven't talked as, I think in part because there's been a lot of talk about race, right? And Joe Biden and Harris and Booker and how they're going after Joe Biden's support in the black community. And we haven't talked about sexism for a while, but to go back to the idea of electability, remember 2016? Like, a lot of people, there was a lot of sexism and like ad nauseum from all the dudes who follow us on Twitter. I got like, well, where's the numbers on that? And it's like, well, you can't apply numbers to sexism everywhere. Some of it just like lies deep in your hearts. But
also like,
but this is not a crazy thing to think that like some of the electability notions surrounding Elizabeth Warren have to do with like, she talks kind of annoying and she reminds me of my teacher. Like people listening to this podcast might be like, that sounds crazy, but people say that stuff and people feel that stuff. So
yeah, I just think if you went to the Republican convention in 2016 and saw the number of signs that called Hillary Clinton a bitch, you probably wouldn't question the extent
and worse.
Yeah, that sexism with them. But just to put some numbers to what Galen asked, a YouGov survey asked people to select each candidate they felt could beat Trump, and Warren was ranked second behind Biden, far behind Biden. 61% of people picked Biden, 46% picked Warren, then came Harris and Sanders at 43%.
And it was a survey in which you could just mark whoever you thought could. So you could pick as many candidates as you want.
And then a Monmouth poll from June asked people to assign a number value from 0 to 10 to each candidate's electability. And Warren placed third at 6.4, behind Biden at 7.1 and Sanders at 6.5. Now, I think a lot of that, to Perry's point, is just like, as her support has grown in the polls, first choice support, there's more people who I think are inclined to answer positively on Warren's behalf in other poll questions, such as these. But look, like, I don't know, this is such a tricky conversation, but like, we know that all else being equal, on average, candidates further from the ideological center do have more trouble in general elections. That's just true. You know, will it apply to Warren if she's the nominee in 2020? Well, I don't know. We also know that, as Claire just said, there's a deep sexism within this country that manifests itself in a lot of ways. Now, studies show that when women run, they win at a rate equal with men, right, in similar conditions. But all those studies are of House races and Senate races and gubernatorial races. And I think there are reasons to suspect that running for president is different. But it's very hard to predict how that will play out. In fact, it's hard enough to predict how that will play out that, like, I don't, you know, the probably safest bet is not to make a bunch of assumptions about who is electable and who isn't. I don't think we know.
You make an ass out of you and me.
Exactly.
Well, right. Also, because
at least out of you,
when you look at 2016, of course, Hillary Clinton won that nomination relatively easily and came very, very close to winning the presidency. And so to take also that information and then say there's no way a woman could win feels like overemphasizing one part of the data and not allowing other parts of the data to speak as well.
No, absolutely.
But I think this is sort of tied into other issues, which is that there is a divide in the Democratic Party between its sort of left-left and its left-center. And a lot of people who don't, Warren's big problem also is that I think she's going to have a real problem if she wins Iowa and New Hampshire. Also, that the that a certain part of the party will endorse anybody else who's standing there to make sure she doesn't win. The same way Sanders had a big problem in 16. I know he's different than Warren, but he had a big problem in 16 that basically every black person in America who was elected official basically endorsed Hillary Clinton the day Sanders won New Hampshire, because the party does not like... the party elites would prefer Harris or Biden to Warren or Sanders.
Yeah.
That's a big issue.
I think that's a really good point. And I would, I think if people want to know a little bit more about sort of the, I would call it like the intellectual arguments on the center left with Warren, if you go into the New Yorker did a profile of her back in June, can Elizabeth Warren win it all? Some of it is like sort of like your basic life story profile thing. But once you get like maybe halfway through, there are some really interesting paragraphs that are from people who are sort of giving the, what's the academic answer to why the wealth tax might not work. And I think it's an interesting preview, perhaps, of what we'll see more of in maybe the later Democratic primary if she keeps doing well, or the general election in certain spheres.
Can she win the Democratic primary without making at least some inroads with black voters? No, right?
I mean, she's got to make inroads with somebody.
Black voters are only... black voters are only, 25% of the electorate? So, yes. But she can't do that without... She can't lose whites without degrees and black voters, which is what she's doing now. So I think it's both and, but, you know, yeah.
I think you're right, Perry, that, like, numerically, sure, she could put together a coalition that gets her above 50%, you know, combining very liberal white voters, college-educated white voters with, let's say... some non-college white voters, let's say some Hispanic voters. Black voters are such an important part of the constituency, though, that I, you know, how I do think, as I said earlier, one advantage Warren has over the Bernie campaign is I think she will be more acceptable to the party establishment. Will the party establishment be okay with a candidate who hasn't shown any appeal with black voters? You know, one reason Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 was black turnout was down. I don't know the answer to this. I'm just curious, like, you know, how much will officials demand, hey, if you want to be our nominee, you got to show an ability to win non-white voters generally and black voters in particular.
One problem with the whole electability conversation that I find to be challenging is I don't think when I talk to voters, I don't think where they know we're talking about it. Like the scenario in which Warren has a 30% chance, but Biden has a 53% chance is different from Biden has 53 and Warren has 59. And it's different than Warren has 75 and Biden has 83. And part of these discussions are harmed by the fact that we don't have sort of a baseline. So so if you asked me, I think it's more in the 50s for both, you know, the 50s for both of them, but right now at least. But I think a lot of voters are not sure if it's like 30 or 70. And I think that's why it's a little hard to talk about is the choice between a slight risk for, because Warren is more left and she's a woman. She's obviously less electable than Biden. That's not very controversial. So, I mean, the question is like how much less electable? And I think people are really struggling with that question. Because we don't really have a good answer to it.
You mean, and you're talking about in head-to-head against Trump, like people are conceptualizing it as Biden would have a 70% chance to win against Trump and Warren would have a 30, when really probably the differences in electability are much more minute. That's an interesting point.
I don't know if I'm not saying that. I'm just saying people are having different conversations. Whether your assumption is it's 70 for one person, 80 for the other, or 30, 40, or Warren will lose and Biden will win, obviously shapes the primary much differently. I don't think it's surprising to people that a more leftward candidate is more risky. What they don't know is how much more risky.
Right. And the thing is, at this point, even if you asked us to come up with some kind of like data answer to this, you head-to-head polling at this point isn't very useful, so we literally couldn't tell you.
No, and not only that, but I think it's fair to say we know something about how the layperson thinks about probabilities, and my not to be an asshole, but excuse me, Claire, you know, you're talking to him, Mike, but they don't think about probabilities in fine detail in like 55% versus 51%. So my supposition from talking to people, but also just from like experiencing how people think about probabilities, is that in their head it probably is, oh, even if it's not articulated this way, oh, Biden has an 80% chance to beat Trump and Warren has a 10% chance.
All right, well, Of course, this is a conversation we will continue to have. But let's move on because we have another topic to talk about, which is the aftermath of the mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem that growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. That's at netsuite.com/538. Again, netsuite.com/538 to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/538. We're back, and it's been a little over 2 weeks since 31 people were killed over a single weekend in mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. Since then, polling has showed an increase in concerns over the threat of white nationalism, and support for stricter gun laws remains the majority opinion, as it has for a while. Congress is still on recess and won't be back until Labor Day, but 2020 Democratic candidates have continued to talk about the attacks on the trail. Perry, I want to start with you. 2 weeks out, does it seem like the El Paso and perhaps maybe Dayton too, but of course El Paso brings in the issue of white nationalist terrorism as well, but does it seem like those mass shootings were a defining moment in American politics?
I think they were, and we can discuss how we define American politics, but I think if you look at how the New York Times and other publications are covering white nationalism, Trump's speeches, Fox News, there's been a lot of stories saying this shooter's words and messages were echoed from Trump's speeches and so on. The manifesto he wrote came from Trump's ideas, essentially. I'm seeing a lot of stories about people calling in or the local law enforcement arresting people who have put up, you know, who have written about white supremacy. And there seems like there's a heightened attention in the public and from law enforcement on the idea that white nationalism and shootings should be coming. So I do think that the media and maybe institutions outside of government in some ways are changing their approach and their sense that white nationalism is big. I think the FBI, my guess, is going to be more focused on this. So I do think institutions are changing, and I think it might be galvanizing in that way without necessarily changing kind of votes in Congress.
Well, my initial response to that question was going to be no. But I think Perry's right. It's like maybe the answer is something like it did produce some lasting change in terms of how, as Perry said, people and institutions treat and think of white nationalism, but not with guns. Because on guns, I don't think we've seen as many changes.
I mean, we've talked about guns before on this podcast, and it's always in the same framework of, like, is public opinion on gun control changing? And I think we've generally come to the conclusion that it has sort of steadily changed and gotten more in favor of gun control. And I would guess push back a little bit and say, so the Republican governor of Ohio, obviously one of the shootings was in Dayton, Mike DeWine called for a version of a red flag law. So it's background checks, things like that. And I think Trump maybe initially wanted to support it, but then perhaps...
Actually, today I think he made some noise about well, remember, we already have a lot of background checks, and it's really about mental health. So he kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess I would say with every shooting, there does seem to be, I think, some nominal change. As far as the idea of talking about white nationalism and talking about white supremacy, which I actually think are, interestingly, those definitions are being refined quite a bit. So talking about right-wing terrorists and using the language of this is a white nationalist, people in the media drawing kind of comparisons to, well, some of the shootings like San Bernardino, that was sort of an ISIS-inspired terrorist attack. So this shooting in El Paso was a white nationalist-inspired terrorist attack. They're essentially the same kind of thing. We should talk about them in the same way. But I think the white supremacy idea is the one you're seeing like Tucker Carlson push back on in this way where he's saying white supremacy is only the KKK and people who go to meetings and tattoo swastikas on their heads and do that kind of thing. Whereas I think a lot of institutions are smartly and rightly talking about white supremacy as the idea that systemic racism exists and that it's promoted in various ways, cultural and political, over hundreds of years. But that's a hard concept for people to get a hold of. And that, I think, has been more difficult. I think the idea of designating white nationalist terrorists in the same category as Muslim terrorism is like an easier job for the media to do. The white supremacy conversation is much harder, and it's tied into slavery and everything that came from that in America. So it's like talking about American history in a radically different way.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I do think the media has, with white nationalist or white supremacist terror attacks, takes up much more of the position as they do with Al-Qaeda terrorism as it existed or ISIS terrorism.
I mean, so are you guys saying that in a way the American conception of the threat of white nationalism has changed? It sounds like yes.
I think the answer is unequivocally yes, that this is a much more serious and well understood threat than it was 3 weeks ago. And that is a meaningful change in the electorate and institutions that matters, even if there's no gun control bill or white nationalism bill that passes next week. I'm not predicting any legislation. I'm just saying that I think that these kinds of cultural changes do matter. And I think something happened in the last 3 weeks.
But you think it'll last, Perry?
I do. I do think there will be more of a focus on somebody wrote some weird post on their Facebook page about how they hate Jews. And I think it'll be more likely that the cops in that city will be like, let me do something before the Walmart gets shot up. I just think there'll be more aggression around these kinds of things in thinking it's like ISIS in a certain way. Like Claire said, I think that is, and I think that is going to be permanent. Yes, I do.
There was a shooting that was supposedly stopped by law enforcement, right? That was similarly motivated, like white nationalism motivated. The identification of that in American media has probably been slightly slowed down by, you know, outlets like Fox News, where if it's a right-wing extremist, aka what we're now calling white nationalism, because it's almost always that, they talk about the mental illness thing, and then that becomes a whole conversation. And so, Mike, it's very apropos that you say that Trump was saying this morning, it's all about mental illness. Like, I do think that that talking point has severely retarded progress of how we talk about that and identify that in media.
In terms of talking about politics, government, we usually talk about, it looks like the House Democrats, when they get back from recess, is going to push bills on banning high-capacity magazines and some kind of red flag law. So it's not like they, you know, it's not surprising they're taking those stands, but they're going to try to ramp up the issue. In terms of the presidential campaign, what you've seen is the big idea that sort of emerged the last 2 weeks is, I think Cory Booker was the first person to have this idea of this kind of national gun licensing, which is kind of something, the idea is like getting a gun license would be important, like a process like getting a passport. You'd have to apply, you'd have to do some interviews, you have to make sure you were crazy, essentially. So it went from being Booker to now Warren, Beto, Castro. That's now kind of a mainstream idea in the party. I don't think Biden's taking it up yet, but there's a lot of candidates on that idea. So I think that's a shift that's happened. And the third one is, Beto's campaign specifically. If you think about the candidates, Biden is kind of running a basically anti-Trump campaign. Trump is the problem with America. You know, Warren and Sanders are running these kind of campaigns along the lines of the big business, the wealthy, they're the problem with America. Beto is now moving pretty fully to a kind of an anti-racism campaign. Racism is the problem. Like, if you've seen him, he went to Mississippi to talk about the ICE situation there. He's in Oklahoma today visiting the memorial for the Oklahoma City bombing. He's been talking, saying racist and talking about racism a lot. I do think Beto, I don't know if it's going to help him win or not, but I do think Beto has sort of amped up his kind of, changed his campaign, made it about kind of racism, bluntly, and I'll be curious how the other candidates react to it, and it's just striking to watch, and I'll be curious to see what 4 months of running is kind of a sort of my campaign as an anti-racism campaign looks like.
Yeah, anti-racism, but also, like, doing the whole thing where he's like, but I'm willing to talk to the other side. Like, he was in Arkansas, and he went to a gun show and talked to gun owner. You're like, there is that kind of, the relaunch of his campaign after the El Paso shooting is interesting. I mean, in his sort of relaunch speech, he kind of addressed, some people say I should run for Senate, but I'm here to, like, fight the higher forces at work in America. I am frankly, like, skeptical of it still. I agree with you, Perry. It'll be interesting to watch, but it's not.
I mean, not to be too cynical, but is he relaunching his campaign if he was at 18% in the polls? No.
Right. You're saying that he wasn't working out and this is another thing that he'll try, and the chances are that given that he already wasn't working out, this won't work out either. Perry outlined some of the ways in which Democrats have responded to the mass shootings, both in Congress and on the 2020 trail. How have Republicans reacted? Claire, you mentioned the governor of Ohio. Have we seen anything? I know Greg Abbott, of course, the governor of Texas, also launched a domestic terrorism task force. What about Trump? What about other Republicans? What has the response been like?
You could describe it a bunch of different ways, but I think there has not been much response from the Republican
Party. Lack of engagement is the response.
Like, look, Democrats, I think if you look at the long history of guns as an issue in this country, there really has been change on the Democratic side. Officials are much more willing to come out forcefully for gun control now than they were 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. I mean, remember, like, John Kerry going duck hunting? Was it ducks?
Goose? I think duck or goose.
Democratic politicians now, and you see this among the 2020 candidates, are very willing to come out forcefully for gun control. Have we seen some Republican officials come out in favor of the red flag law, or Trump signed the bump stock thing? I think the era of mass shootings, if you can call it that, has resulted in Republican officials being more willing to pay some lip service to gun control and then to nibble around the edges a little bit policy-wise. But are Republicans going to get on board with an assault weapons ban? Or no. Perry, do you think there's any chance Republicans in Congress would get on board with a ban on high-capacity magazines?
No, of course not. Our assault weapons. But I do. So what I see is, and this happened after the shooting in Parkland too, is initially Trump and McConnell say, I'm open to anything. Let's have a big discussion. I don't want to be too cynical to say this, but it seems like they're sort of running out the clock in a certain way.
No, of course. Absolutely.
The first few days is we're prepared to do re-election. The next week it's like, and by the time, look, Mitch McConnell's very smart. He knew the shooting happened in August and Congress was starting in September. So he was able to make comments that they were maybe, if not disingenuous, he knew the heat would be off of him by the time Congress back up in September. So my guess is Trump will do something in the executive branch to sort of make it harder for people who are mentally ill to buy guns. It won't pass in Congress, because I don't think most Republicans in Congress want to vote for a gun control bill, but I think if Trump can give us some kind of cover, that's what I'll expect to see.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good explanation of where things stand at this point. So with that, let's wrap it up. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, Perry.
All right. Thanks, Galen. Thanks, guys.
And two reminders before we let everyone go. One, merch. We still have merch, and I think they do it kind of in periodic orders, and I think the next one expires in 3 days. So go to 538.com/store for 538 merch. And then the other reminder is that you can now watch this podcast on ABC News Live. So on Tuesday in the afternoon, you can go check it out live there, or you can see it on our YouTube channel after the fact. Watch us all talk to each other and have fun and laugh and talk about serious things too.
And while you're there, also check out the video the 538 podcast producer Tony Chow made quizzing 538 staff whether they could tell the difference between sports commentary and political punditry. Actual quotes.
What's the headline?
The headline is, can you tell sports commentary from political punditry?
And the answer is no. Yeah. You can't.
Well,
but you should go watch it to find out.
It's pretty freaking hard.
All right. For now, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us as people are getting back from vacation and heading back to work and paying attention to the primary and politics, because what else are you going to do when you get back to work? Just scroll through Twitter. Tell people to check us out. Anyway, thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.